This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Happy New Year, Jennifer, and Happy New Year, listeners. We are so excited to get a new season of Solve It for Kids podcast going. And can I just tell you right now, we are starting off with a supersonic boom.
Ooh, I'm guessing that is a lead-in to what the big question is. So what is the question? What are we solving today?
Why does a plane make a sonic boom?
Why does a plane make a sonic boom? This sounds really exciting. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the one and only Nils Larsen, NASA test pilot.
Oh, this is going to be out of this world. Welcome to the show, Nils.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, we are so excited to have you on the show. I mean, being a NASA test pilot, what is that like? What does your day look like as a NASA test pilot?
Well, it kind of depends. You know, now I go to a lot of meetings, but earlier when I was doing a lot more flight tests, you know, at least a few times a week, you know, we would go up and do different test missions. Sometimes we chase other test missions. You know, we have a safety chase that goes along that checks out the other aircraft, make sure it's okay. So
I never knew that.
Well, sometimes you have to be a target for certain things, you know, when you're trying to, say, look at a different radar or something like that. So okay. I was in the Air Force as a test pilot for about 10 years before I came down to NASA. So I have a bunch of experience from there. And then I've been at NASA for about 15 years now doing various types of flight testing different concepts that we might have, including stuff that goes, you know, into space, using airplanes to do that. And then we'll use airplanes to go around the world and do research, trying to get information on the climate when it comes to climatology and that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's so cool.
That really is. So first things first, go Air Force. Yay for that. And now that I'm Galactic Space Geek, Jeff, go NASA. I have to continue that line of questioning just a little bit before we jump into some more specifics. When I hear NASA test pilot as a space geek, the only thing that comes to mind are three words, the right stuff, because all of the original astronauts were military test pilots. What is it like walking around knowing that you have the right stuff?
Well, I work at Armstrong Flight Research Center, and it's named after the guy, you know, that we all know and love.
Yes.
If you're a space geek,
sure.
You know,
yes.
And he worked there. So, I mean, he worked in the same office. It's legends like himself or Joe Walker or Scott Crossfield. It's just really surreal to sit in the same desk, you know,
sure.
These guys who are legends. I mean, the right stuff is what got me to become a test pilot. When a teacher handed me that book and said, read this. And I went, ooh, now I know what I want to be when I grow up. So it's really just amazing. I did have the pleasure of meeting Mr. Armstrong several times, along with Crossfield and other legends that are out there. And it just, you never feel worthy to be.
Yes, I would feel the same way. I mean, wow, that's just incredible. Okay, so the question or the problem or whatever you're going to solve is, why does a plane make a sonic boom? So let's talk a little bit about that and the project you're working on right now.
All right. Well, why does a plane make a sonic boom? Well, it only makes a sonic boom if it's going faster than the speed of sound. Now, one of the things that a lot of people think is that when it hits Mach 1, that's the only time it makes the boom. Not true. As long as it's going faster than the speed of sound, it's making the boom and it's dragging it across the ground with it.
I did not know that.
It's exactly. Most people think it's, you know, it's a barrier and it punches through and then it's done.
Right.
You know, no. It just, you know, keeps dragging it, you know, along with it. So once again, faster than the speed of sound, you're going to make a sonic boom. Now,
okay.
Have you ever heard a sonic boom?
Yes, actually, I was going to say that about a month or so ago. I think it was SpaceX was coming back to Kennedy. It was about 11 o'clock at night and my husband and I heard this boom and like the house shook and we didn't know what we thought it was a tree. And it was really funny. So we go outside, we're looking around, our neighbors are outside. Everybody's looking around like, what the heck was this? And then we hear the next morning on TV, that was a sonic boom that went over. It was crazy. Well,
most people don't realize that pretty much everybody's heard a sonic boom.
Huh.
And that is thunder. Thunder.
Oh,
is a sonic
boom. Florida, we hear that all the time.
Exactly. So, you know, basically the air gets heated, you know, superheated by the lightning when it comes down, which causes a shockwave, and the shockwave is what makes that sonic boom.
Okay.
So now if we go back to an airplane, when it's going faster than the speed of sound. So as the airplane moves through the atmosphere, think of it, we always talk about the atmosphere or air like a fluid. So
Right. Think
of it like a boat that's on the water and you see the wake that comes, you know, from a boat that's, you know, on the water. Same thing happens in an airplane. So, you know, as you're going through the air, you're going to have the, you know, the wake, if you will, coming off the airplane. But eventually all those little wakes, you know, as the airplane starts going faster and faster and faster, they get all crunched together, if you think of it that way.
Right.
You know, and that becomes at Mach 1. You basically have now crunched those all together to where that creates that shock wave and that pressure differential. So that produces a shock wave. And then the shock wave, just like lightning, you know, makes the sonic boom.
Whoa.
Okay. So you're flying in the plane that creates this sonic boom. I've never had a chance to ask a test pilot, do you feel that in the plane?
No, and it's always one of those things that if you ever get a chance to take somebody, you know, on a flight, they always want to go faster than the speed of sound. It's really not that exciting.
Faster.
Yeah. It's not that exciting other than you're going really fast. In the plane, you won't really notice it most of the time. If you look at the altimeter, you'll see the altimeter swing around, basically go crazy for a little bit right as you go through Mach 1 because the shock wave moves across the static port. And that's what feeds the altimeter. So you'll see it kind of jump around as you go through Mach 1. Now, you can, this is kind of weird, you can sometimes see your shock wave or see the shock wave of another airplane if you're chasing it. So just the other day was one of the first times I've seen shock waves from other airplanes. I've seen my shock wave in relation to another airplane. But the other day when I was flying with somebody, I looked down and as I looked down, I saw a road that goes down there and I could see the shock wave on the road. So it really depends on the atmospheric, you know, where the light is coming from, where the, you know, how much, you know, moisture is in the atmosphere and that. But essentially the weird thing is it looks like a clear line. So when I was looking at the road, you know, what ends up happening is, you know, because of that pressure change, causes a temperature change, causes a density change when it happens there. So what ends up happening is the light refracts or bends slightly differently because of that change in the density.
Okay.
So the weird thing is if you have a nice crisp line, all of a sudden you'll look and the line won't be quite straight. There will be a little jag to it. And that, and then if you look really closely, there will be a clear line right there, and that's your shockwave. So it's really weird. Now, we've done, you can see pictures out there that NASA's done. It's called Schlieren photography.
Ooh, okay.
So that is, you know, a picture of the shockwave. So many years ago, you'll see it all the time in a wind tunnel. But we finally managed to get some pictures of an actual airplane in flight. And it was done many years ago at Langley, and they got one picture and could never really recreate it consistently. And then for years, we had been trying it here. And then we found a method to do it. And that was an engineering problem that we overcame through some trial and error a little bit. And then looking at some new ways of thinking. So one of the things that we did when we were trying to do this was you have to be really, really accurate because the camera that you're trying to use to take this picture usually is going to stare at the sun, and then you're going to look at, or it looks at a speckled background maybe on the ground. There's a couple ways you can do this.
Okay.
But, you know, there's not a big field of view when you stare through, you don't want to stare through the camera at the sun, but, you know, when you put the camera at the sun, that would be bad. Don't do that. But you're trying to get the airplanes and the sun, you know, it's almost literally trying to get the planets to align, but it's, you know, trying to get two planes to align with the sun. Or two planes to align with a specific thing on the ground.
So you can get at the right view for the camera to see it because...
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, the problem is, originally, and it depends on how they set the camera, and when they first set up the camera, they gave us a bigger field of view. And then we actually started getting good at it. So they started using, you know, different lenses.
Then they made it harder?
Made it harder and harder on us. Yeah, once we finally started to figure out how to do it. But it was interesting when we finally figured out how to go do it, we had always been trying to use a system that we had created that used what we call air-to-air modems. So we had really accurate GPSs that would know where each airplane was and where the sun was or the point on the ground. So we were trying to do that. And it was just hard to get all of the different pieces to work.
Sure.
And one day when we were sitting there, I said, well, wait a minute. Why don't we change this around? And this was originally... It wasn't quite so hard because we weren't using the sun. We were using a patch of desert, speckled desert on the ground to produce that background. So we looked and said, well, wait a minute. Why don't I just make, instead of relative to each other, why don't we just go relative to the Earth instead? So, you know, so we said, we're just going to draw a line on the ground that isn't a GPS line on the ground. You know, and then in our old F-18s that we were flying at the time, we said, well, I don't have GPS accurate enough, except we had a handheld GPS that was accurate enough. So we mounted it in there and then we ended up flying and we could fly the line and be exactly underneath the airplane. Later, when we decided to use the camera, we used a technique where the camera on the ground would look at the sun and then we would try and fly through the field of view.
Sure.
Which is really tiny when you're looking at the sun.
Yeah.
So what we ended up doing once again was, you know, we said, well, we're just going to use a GPS line. So you're going to have to, we're going to have to guess at what time we're going to pass. You're going to give me a point to fly to. I'm going to fly to that point. And it was funny because the other engineers are like, we don't think you can do it accurately. And I said, I think we can. I said, you know, I think we can do it. I said, not saying my skills. I said, we know we can get within 100 feet of the line, you know, at Mach 1 point, whatever. So in the end, what we said was, I said, you know what we'll do is I'll put two airplanes up right next to each other. So one of the two of them
there you go
to fly through the field of view. And then the other engineer said, and I'll put two cameras on the ground to even increase our chances. And guess what? It worked. So.
Well, and I mean, that's what you do when you're engineers. And I mean, I'm thinking that how cool is that, that you're actually going, you know, your job to do this is to fly supersonic. Oh, hey, it didn't work. Let's go up and fly the plane again. Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
well, we practice flying supersonic because the guys we work with, the guys and gals we work with, they are, you know, they want exacting tolerances. When I said 100 feet, they really want 10 feet. You know, so, you know, and 10 feet's really hard to do when you're moving that fast.
I would,
you
know, think so.
Most of the time they get what they get, but, you know, we sometimes have bragging rights between the test pilots when you say, you know, when they call the mark and you say, I was 20 feet off. Ooh, that's pretty good. The next guy comes back and he says, I was 9 feet off. Go beat that. You know, so, you know, so that's, you know, you get the fun competition that goes on there.
That's what the rest of us know about the test pilot world.
Yeah. It is a little competitive, or it can be. Yeah.
Well, I mean, why not? So, okay. So let's talk a little bit about the X-59, because we've talked about the sonic boom, and right. I'm assuming that's not a, you know, having heard that and it kind of scared the bejesus out of us, I'm assuming people don't like to hear those. So talk a little bit about the X-59 and what you're trying to do with that plane.
Okay. Well, right now, you know, you're not supposed to make a sonic boom over land. So, you know, it happens.
Okay.
There are people, you know, SpaceX does it, NASA does it, the military does it. You know, you can get special permission to make sonic booms. But generally speaking, you're not supposed to make a sonic boom, you know, over land. Most of the time, you know, if you're out over the water or out away from people, you know, it's not a problem because people don't like it. It can break windows. It's pretty rare, depending on how strong the boom and the pressure wave is that goes through. But years ago, when they did a study, I think it was in Oklahoma City back in the 1960s, mm-hmm. in the middle 60s, they did a bunch of tests and people said, nope, no more. We don't want this. So right now, the regulations say that you cannot fly faster than the speed of sound over land unless you got special permission. Okay. So commercial airliners aren't allowed to go faster than the speed of sound. Now, we used to have the Concorde.
Right.
And the Concorde, right. It used to be able to do it and would only do it over water. But they really wanted to be able to go all the way to Dallas supersonic and not have to slow down because the airplane wasn't designed to go. It was way less efficient and it wasn't nearly as cool, you know, because once you got to, you know, the East Coast, you had to slow down when you were coming from London or whatever. So one of the things that we looked at, we said, well, wait a minute. If we don't like the noise, then instead of restricting the speed to just Mach 1, why don't we restrict it based on the noise? Because we had done some research at NASA and various companies that were out there and said, you know what? We think we can design an airplane to make that boom quieter. As a matter of fact, we can make it not a boom, but more of a thump.
Oh,
so
wow.
In X-59, we're actually trying to take all of the lessons we've learned over the years from various things we've done with other airplanes and small modifications and build a purpose-built airplane so that we can make a sonic thump. And then if we can go use that, the idea is eventually we're going to take this, and this is unique for an X-plane, we're going to take it on the road. We're going to take it to a city near you, and
you guys...
are actually going to be our test subjects. So you guys are going to be able
here,
to help
come
us.
Here.
Yeah, and you guys are going to be part of our experiment. You guys are going to be engineers and scientists, and you're going to help us determine what the noise level could or should be. So we'll fly over, and then
you'll be
able to rate, you know, whether that was too loud or, you know, made the dog bark or it scared the kids or whatever it has to be. So,
the windows, no.
Right. No, we're not going anything that would do that. The big thing that I've heard, you know, because we have a way that we can make what we call a shaped boom with the F-18. It's just a very specific area and it's not as easy to control as we would like it. So that's why we had to go build a purpose-built airplane to do this.
Right.
But whenever we've done that before, I've been in a conversation with somebody while one of the NASA pilots was flying this maneuver. And as we were talking, just like you and I are talking right now, I had to interrupt them really quick and go, wait, did you just hear that? And they went, oh yeah, I think I did. And I'm like, that was a low boom. That was a sonic thump, not a sonic boom.
Wow.
And they had been used to hearing the big ba-boom that we have here when the F-15 or the F-18 flies normally. And they were like, wow, that is good. I said, yeah, you'd even notice it until I stopped our conversation. I said, that's what we're shooting for. You know, it should sound a little bit like distant rolling thunder. We'll go back to that lightning thunder thing.
Right.
Or somebody closing a car door. You know,
Yeah,
so
that's quiet.
That's a lot quieter.
So generally, you know, it can be, we think, pretty, you know, there's other things that you will hear that would probably be more disturbing than a sonic thump. But we'll see, you know, and the idea is if the public are the ones that, you know, didn't like it before, well, we need to get the public to tell us, no, that's fine, you know. And then once we do that, then all the designers, if they can design their airplanes, and that's the other part of the X-59 is it's the design, you know, if they can go, okay, I can use some of the DNA from their design on the X-59 to go create my commercial airplane. So the X-59 is not a prototype. It is specifically built to go out and get this data.
Wow.
Okay. So I heard you say that it's a purpose-built aircraft for that.
Right.
But what we were talking about before on how the sonic boom gets made, that's based on the speed of the aircraft.
Right.
So how does the design of the aircraft change it from a sonic boom down to a sonic thump?
Oh, wow. You are a great straight man. So if you ever look at the picture of an X-59, so I challenge your listeners to go out there and find a picture of it.
Nice.
It looks like a dart. So it's about 100 feet long. I think it's like 4 inches shy of 100 feet long.
Wow. Something like that.
And it's about 30 feet wide, wingtip to wingtip. But when you look at it, every time an airplane goes, and we talk about those Schlieren pictures, you can go out there and look at some of the Schlieren pictures, you'll see that there's lots of shock waves that come off the airplane. Every time the airplane makes a little bend or an antenna sticks out or something like that, there's going to be a shock wave that comes off the airplane. So what ends up happening is all these shock waves that come off the airplane, as they move toward the ground, they actually start to come together a little bit. Just like, you know, waves on the ocean, when you see two waves come together and kind of amplify.
Right.
So that's part of the problem, is that all these shocks coming off the airplane, as they move away, you know, will start to come together. And if you look at some of those Schlieren pictures, you'll actually be able to see some of those smaller shocks starting to kind of come together.
Wow.
Well, in the X-59, it's got a really big long nose on that thing.
Okay.
So, and it doesn't change much for, I don't know, about 20 feet. Because if you ever look at the nose of that thing, the cockpit of the X-59 is about halfway back that airplane. The nose gear, I'm not sure why we call it a nose gear, because it's actually behind my butt. So, you know, so
pilot's butt gear didn't make the cut.
No, probably not. Yeah. But if you look at it, the idea is to have all those shock waves come off and be a lot more distance in between them. So that as they go down through the atmosphere, they're eventually becoming weaker and weaker, and they're not able to get together and strengthen themselves. So the weird thing is, if you were to ever go put a microphone out and listen to a normal shockwave, most normal shockwaves form what we call an N wave. We call it an N wave because if you were to plot it, you know, the loudness versus time,
yep,
it looks
sure
like a big N. So hence an N wave.
Sure.
So what ends up happening, if you were to ever look at what the X-59 should produce, that very first part of the N where it shoots up, and that's the thing that gets most people
right
when it comes to a sonic boom. It's the startle factor. It's that firecracker pow.
It is,
know,
yes.
Thing. So it's that really rapid thing over time, that rapid loudness, if you will, over time.
Sure.
So if we can make it both less loud, you know, and spread that out
and
all over
spread it
time,
out. Okay.
If you think of it, instead of bang, it's more like thump, you know, when it comes down to it. So that is one of the main things that does it. There's some other things that we can do when it comes to the lift distribution on the airplane that helps with that tail end of the shock. But that is probably the biggest thing that we can play with. There's other little things that you might see in the design if you look at the picture of that airplane, like the inlet lip, you know, for the engine is on the top of the airplane, and it's forward of the end of the wing. So the shock wave that comes off is kind of blocked by the wing. So there's other weird little pieces of the design that are designed to not produce as many of those shock waves or not let them, you know, come together when it comes down to it.
I mean, the engineering is unbelievable.
There's some really smart people at NASA and Lockheed and Boeing and Gulfstream and, you know, all these different companies, you know, Boom and all these people who have been working on this, you know, problem for a long while.
Wow. Okay. So we were talking a little bit about this before, but how do you see if you're on, you know, if you're on this big long nose in front of
you and you're halfway back?
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, isn't it almost kind of like you're trying to stare out the end of your nose? So how do you see where you're going?
Well, if you think about it, it's a really, really long nose. So the problem is there's no forward windshield. So like, you know, so if your car is sitting there, there is no windshield because, you know, it's just such a long nose. There's no windshield on there. So you're thinking,
my gosh,
how do you see out the front? Well,
my pilot's blind. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Charles Lindbergh did this back in, you know, 1927, was it? You know,
yes.
So, I mean, he had to look out the window. But in this case, we can't really stick our head out the window. It really doesn't matter.
Fast.
So what we've done is we've created a virtual windscreen. So what we do is we have cameras on the top and the bottom of the airplane that both come to a, if you will, a monitor or television screen that's in the cockpit. So we have a 4K UHD camera on the top, and then a 4K monitor. The camera that's on the bottom is a little more specialized. It's not quite as good a resolution as the upper camera.
Yeah.
But it's more typical of what you'd see in some of the aircraft that are already out there that use them for, you know, heads-up displays and stuff like that. So it basically produces the outside. We do have side windows that we can look out the side. So we've got that, you know, but for looking forward, it's a virtual window.
Okay. So that's what it is in this, in your X-59, which is the purpose-built test plane. Is that what it's going to be when this plane eventually gets into production?
Well, once again, since it's not a prototype, but this is one of the technologies that you would probably see in this aircraft and possibly other aircraft in the future.
Okay.
Because even if you look at, even if you go out and you look at a lot of the airplanes that are out there now, more and more of them, more of the modern airplanes, you'll kind of notice where that windscreen is. It used to almost have a little bit of a bump or a hump there where the nose was. Now, many more airplanes, it's almost like a straight curve back because, you know, it produces a lot more drag if you have that little bump there. So one of the things that you might be able to do if this technology proves to be useful and reliable is that you might actually see in other airplanes that aren't supersonic where they use some of the same ideas to, you know, cut down some of the field of view so that you can have some drag reduction, but still have the true full field of view because some of it would be virtual. So, you know, if you remember, the Concorde had a nose that would droop.
Yes.
And they had to have the nose that would droop so they could, when they came into land. But otherwise, you know, it doesn't have nearly as long a nose as that X-59, but it is still pretty long and pointed. But, you know, when they were going fast, that thing was up. But if you think about it, if you were going to probably design a supersonic airliner, it would probably have a really long nose and it would probably have the same problem the X-59 does. And it would probably end up having, so that was great. Once again, a great straight man.
Yeah.
It probably will have a virtual windshield.
That's cool. Now, how do you land this? You know, because I think that's also something that might be a little more difficult with a really, really long plane.
And you're right. You can't, you have to worry about coming in and scraping the tail when it comes down to it.
Right.
So, you know, so there are certain limits we have as we come in. One of the things that we have, if you've ever seen the space shuttle or videos of the space shuttle when it lands and they have a heads up display, because our window is a monitor, we can put the same kind of stuff that you would have for a heads up display. So we have attitude indicator on it. We have airspeed, we have altitude, we have all kinds of stuff, but we also have these, what we call a flare cue, just like the space shuttle has. So you'll put the, you know, we say you put the thing on the thing when it comes to the pilot. So there's a flight path marker. So the computers on the airplane can tell you exactly where the airplane is going. So it puts a little circle there with a couple little tick marks on it that looks kind of like the back end of an airplane if you were staring at it. So that's where the airplane is going. And then eventually there will be these two things. Right now they look like little pluses and they start marching up from the bottom when you get about 200 feet. And then as they pass that little flight path marker, you just pull back and match the pluses with the flight path marker and it'll just flare it out. So it's very, very similar to the way they landed the shuttle. As a matter of fact, our deputy administrator, Pam Melroy, who is a shuttle commander, she was out probably a couple months ago and actually flew our simulator. You know,
I said,
this will look familiar to you, ma'am. You know, as you come in here and try and land the thing. So, very similar to the way they did some of the stuff with the space shuttle. Now, we have some backup techniques that we've also devised when it comes to, you know, looking out the window or for us in the very beginning until we prove the system. There's other ways that we can get down safely.
Wow.
Okay. Is that scary at all? I mean, I know you're a test pilot, and I know my very first question was about the right stuff, which kind of sets a bar. But at some point, are you nervous of like, okay, what if that camera on top cuts out and I just can't see?
So far, no. But it is funny because that is probably one of the bigger questions that a lot of people ask, including our own engineers, including our own safety experts, you know, and basically we have to look at, you know, when we design stuff, we have to look at what are the failure modes, just like what you're proposing here. So one of the things we have to look at when we develop our emergency procedures, when we develop our normal procedures, are what are all the pieces, what can go wrong, and what are we going to do if they go wrong? So you don't want to figure it out on the fly. You already know what you want to do, you know, if something breaks. So in our case, you know, we have two cameras, an upper and a lower. And the lower one really is three cameras, and it's in three different bands. So you have some redundancy when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. The airplane also has synthetic vision in it. So it has really accurate GPS, and it knows where it is in the world. And just like in a simulator, it can actually put up what looks like the real world, but is not the real world. So if the camera goes out, you can actually land virtually. We frequently land using the radar altimeter a lot, and that's what helps drive that flare cue. Even if the flare cue doesn't work, before we ever implemented the flare cue, we would just land using the radar altimeter. And when we saw 50 feet, we would start moving the flight path marker up to just below the horizon and let the airplane set down, and it works great. So if, you know, certain things aren't working, you know, there's another backup. You can see out the sides, you know, to a degree.
Right.
So part of the thing is get yourself relatively lined up. And that's the hardest part, really, is the lineup left and right. Not so much, you know, how long you are. It's a little bit of it. But the hardest part is knowing. And as we joke, we're like, if you can see the runway, then you're not lined up on it. So.
Very true. That means you're
pointed
downwards.
If you don't see it, there might be a chance that you're actually lined up on it. But
I never thought of that.
The other thing is, early on when we're flying, we'll have a chase airplane. We talked about that before.
Yeah.
One of the things we can do, and you've seen probably like the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds fly and do a formation landing.
Yes.
Sure.
So one of the things that we could do if we really need to is we fly off the wing of our chase airplane and just follow them down and then land that way. So, you know, early on, if we're not sure about the reliability of certain systems, there's lots of different things that we've looked into, you know, what if, how are we going to, you know, compensate for that? But, you know, that's much of what we have to actually do as test pilots and flight testers is, you know, we look at the hazards that are out there. You know, you look at it through design, and number one, you want to improve the design so that you can get rid of the hazard. That's the number one thing you want to do. And then if you can't do that, you look for different procedures, different training and things like that, that will compensate for a deficiency or something along those lines.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the show is about, right? Solving all these problems. This is what engineers and test pilots and everybody does for their daily job. Sounds like there's lots of problems that you address every day.
Right.
Well, and figure out how to solve it.
Yeah, as you pointed out, sometimes you have something break and then you have to figure out what you're going to do. You know, when it comes to flight tests, you better think about what happens if it breaks before it breaks.
Before it breaks.
And the same thing is true with space flight. You know, when it comes to the, you know, those guys sit around and think about what happens, what are we going to do if, you know, space flight, once again, from the right stuff, was born from the same pieces. I found it very interesting when I showed up here to Armstrong, they would always refer to, it wasn't pilot entry when they briefed the time that I was going to go get in the cockpit. It was crew entry. And I went, what in the world? What? You know, it's only me in the airplane. Where do they get this crew entry thing? You know, and I said, oh, it's because we're the space organization. That's why. In reality, I figured out after reading another book, it's actually the other way around. They got it from us because the original rocket planes, when they were doing much of that stuff, it was actually referenced back to that. And if you were going to go fly the X-1, say, and you're in the B-29, when you were flying up there, crew entry meant that's when, you know, Chuck Yeager or Tick Lilly or one of those guys was going to go get into the X-1 and close it up, you know.
Oh,
and
that was
crew entry. So you went, oh, okay, I guess the space guys got that stuff from us.
All right. You're welcome.
Yes,
exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, and many of the people that worked out here in the High Speed Research Center, you know, back in the 50s, then went to Langley and eventually, you know, off to Johnson to go be the people, you know, running the manned spaceflight program.
Wow.
Sure. Well, you have talked about some amazing things.
Yes.
I have to ask, what is the favorite aircraft that you've flown?
Well, I'll give you the test pilot answer, because my favorite airplane is whatever
the next
I'm flying
one
today.
Yes. So,
okay.
But I didn't get to fly today. I got the, you know, let's see. So I flew yesterday, and that was the F-15. So I'll go with the F-15 from yesterday. But tomorrow I'm going to go fly the DC-8. So how cool is that? You get to fly an F-15 one day and a DC-8 one day.
That is really cool.
B-4 one day. And it's hard to pick. You know, I flew the U-2, and that is a hard airplane to fly. It is by far. I mean, I've flown around 100 different aircraft, from blimps to helicopters to the U-2. And the U-2, you know, stands out as probably the hardest airplane to fly. Helicopters, that takes some doing, you know, and learning that. It's different. Up and away, they fly like an airplane. But when you want to hover, hats off to my rotary brothers. and sisters, it's not the easiest thing in the world, especially if you grew up, you know, flying fixed wing airplanes. But, and it's fun to go fast. You know, the Eagle's a lot of fun to just go Mach 2, because, you know, you need to drag the experiment out to Mach 2. They want to go see how it performs out there. You know, we're going to test the new wing on the bottom of the F-15.
It sounds like an awful job that you have, Nils.
It's tough. Yeah. Somebody's got to do it. I'm glad it's me.
So when will the X-59 be flying? Sometime next year, in 2021 sometime? 2022.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't even know what day it is.
2022. Right now we're slated, I think first flight date is sometime in the summer of 2022, but we'll see. They're still, you know, finishing up lots of parts, and COVID has not helped us out when it comes to getting things built.
Wow.
All right. Nils, this has been absolutely fantastic. We could probably talk to you about those 100 different aircraft that you've flown for hours and hours, but our listeners aren't going to listen that long. So did you bring along a test pilot kind of a challenge for our listeners?
Well, since we're talking about sonic booms and sound today, I thought we'd do a couple of challenges. So one's going to be a little harder to do, and the other will be a little easier to do. So my first challenge is, I want our listeners to figure out, is the speed of sound faster in water or in air?
Oh,
so before you look it up,
I like that.
Think about what your hypothesis is and why you think it's faster in one or the other, or maybe it's the same. And why would it be? So then go look it up, and then figure out why, once you look it up, it is either one's faster than the other or the same.
Wow.
So that's one of them. That's a research thing. And, you know, if
Very
you're
good.
A pilot or an engineer, you do a lot of research. The other one, since we talked about sound and the speed of sound, so let's talk about the speed of sound in air. So we talked about lightning before. So if you ever have a thunderstorm moving through your area, when you see the flash of light, then count the number of seconds until you hear the thunder. So for each second you count, that's about 1,100 feet, you know, that the sound has moved. So if you count to five, that means it's been about a mile. So, and if you count less than a second, you're way too close to the lightning.
Take cover, especially if you're in Florida.
And so don't do this outside. Stay in your house or your car. But if you see the flash of light, sit there and count one potato, two potato, three potato, four potato, five. Boom. There you go. That was about a mile away.
Wow.
Okay.
I love both of those challenges. Those are so amazing.
I mean, I still do it. I did it as a kid, but if we're out here in a thunderstorm, I'll sit there and see how far away the lightning was.
We do that in Florida to be safe, because the lightning's there all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be on the golf course. Yeah.
No, not on the golf course. This has been a fabulous discussion. Thank you so much for being on Solve for Kids today, Nils.
It was my pleasure. It was great talking to you and your listeners.
Well, if that wasn't a fantastic way to kick off a new season of the Solve It for Kids podcast, I don't know what is. NASA test pilot, all of those cool airplanes, to include one that's in development right now. He's flown more than 100 aircraft. Jennifer, what do you think?
I think it was so much fun, and I hope that the X-59 flies over where I live, because I want to be one of those people that is listening for the thump. right?
Agreed. I want to hear a sonic thump and then be able to give some feedback and say I was one of the research pilots for him. So I want to make sure that we remind you guys, he just gave us two cool challenges. And if you guys choose to do those, be sure to share those with us on our social media at KidSolve on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check out all of our episodes on our website, solveitforkids.com, where you can comment on our episodes. Listen to us next week on
Solve It for Kids. Thank you.